Welcome to The Crimson Threat. I'm John Behrens, pastor of Restoration Messianic Fellowship in the Boulder-Longmont area of northern Colorado. Our website is crimsonthread.com. This study was recorded during our normal Tuesday evening Bible study. Enjoy the study. I'm going to start the book of Daniel tonight. Before we get into it, some background. It's basically divided into either two or three parts, depending on how you count. The first six chapters are historical. They give the history of Daniel and how he got there and all that kind of stuff. And then from seven on are a series of visions that God gave Daniel at various times. In the middle, in chapter four, is the only section that I know of in the Hebrew Bible that is not written in Hebrew. It's written in Aramaic. And it is the testimony of Nebuchadnezzar. So it's written as I, Nebuchadnezzar, and so forth. So you've got chapter four that's written by Nebuchadnezzar, or one of his flunkies, and made it into scripture, which is kind of cool. You know, it says in Jeremiah and other places that the Babylonian captivity was to last 7 years, or 70 years, I'm sorry. And the idea being that it was giving the land its Sabbath rest for all of the time that the Hebrews did not observe the sabbatical year. Well, it turns out that the Neo-Babylonian Empire, and there were two Babylonian empires, the Old Babylonian Empire and the Neo-Babylonian Empire. You all have heard of Hammurabi, the lawgiver and so forth. He was the Old Babylonian Empire. The Neo-Babylonian Empire was basically under Nabopolassar and his son, Nebuchadnezzar, and that empire lasted 70 years. I mean, you go along in history, it's really interesting. Babylon is sort of a backwater place after the fall of the original Babylonian empire, and then all of a sudden it pops up, becomes the dominant power in the region for 70 years, and then gets conquered by the Persians and disappears. So as you look at it from a biblical point of view, what becomes fairly obvious is God needed Babylon to chasten Israel. So basically God grew them up like a mushroom out of nothing, made them into the dominant power. They conquered Judah and took Judah into exile, and Judah's in exile for 70 years, and then they go away. I mean, it's just sort of like this little blip in the radio, just whoop, blip, 70 years down and out they go. Really kind of fascinating. Anyway, the first noteworthy event in Babylonian history, the big battle that sort of establishes them as the 500-pound gorilla on the battlefield, is the Battle of Carchemish. And that was in 605 BC. And if you look up here on this map, you'll see Carchemish is right up there on the Euphrates River. And so Babylon is down here. You see it between the Tigris and Euphrates. And the battle that took place here was between the Babylonians and the Egyptians. The Babylonians won and drove the Egyptians out. And so at that point, all of this area that had been occupied by Egypt, which includes Israel, went over to the Babylonians. And the Babylonians didn't occupy it, but the Israelites became basically a vassal state. In other words, they weren't conquered, but they were under tribute. And according to the commentaries I've read, that was the time when Daniel and his companions got taken to Babylon. So the idea would have been, okay, we've put this whole area under tribute, and what we're going to do is we're going to take some of the nobility of the major nations in that area, we're going to bring their children to Babylon, and it's going to be sort of a hostage situation. You know, we've got your young people here, and as long as you behave, they'll be treated well, and they'll be part of our court, and we'll take care of them, and we'll educate them, and we'll feed them well, and, you know, all that kind of stuff, and they'll be honored members of our society, but sort of unstated thing back there is if you guys make trouble for us, you may never see these kits again. So anyway, the commentary I had says that it was about 604 BC, which is a year after the Battle of Carchemish, that Daniel and his companions went to Babylon. Under Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon tried to invade Egypt in 601 BC, and that didn't go well. He got repulsed. And as part of that process, the Israelites and so forth were encouraged that perhaps the Babylonian Empire's grip on things was weakened and Jerusalem rebelled. So then in 597 BC, they came down and they captured Jerusalem. This is not the destruction of Jerusalem, it's the capture of Jerusalem. So it was now a more stringent kind of an arrangement than it had been before. Then 10 years later, under King Jehoiakim, they rebelled again, and Babylon came in 587 BC and destroyed the city of Jerusalem, flattened the temple. You know, everything is now gone. Most of Israel then got taken as captives back to Babylon. So again, if the commentary I've read is correct, and I think it probably is, given the first chapter, Daniel and his companions were taken basically, 18 years before the destruction. So they have been in Babylon at this point, by the time Jerusalem is destroyed, for 18 years. And they got there under very different circumstances than, for example, Ezekiel and his crowd got there. They got there as captives. Daniel and his group got there as hostages and were treated very differently. So by the time Jerusalem was destroyed, Daniel and his companions were well integrated into the Babylonian government. Their treatment was very different than would have been the slaves that were taken at the destruction of Jerusalem. That comment was that at the time Daniel was taken, he probably would have been in his teens, and I would agree with that. In other words, the idea he's a hostage, he's going to live there for a long time. You know, settle down, kid, and get a job because you're going to be there for a while. But still a young man as an heir or a child of a royal family in Israel, or an upper class family in Israel. At the time all of this happened, the northern kingdom has been destroyed by Assyria, which is the empire preceding the Babylonian Empire. As I say, about 125 years earlier, the 10 northern tribes had been destroyed. So Jerusalem and the southern kingdom at that point were under tribute, if you will, to the Assyrian Empire. And Babylon, of course, destroyed Assyria, and that gave rise to the first of the rebellions of the southern kingdom, which caused Nebuchadnezzar to invade, formally put them under tribute, and then, of course, the second rebellion is when they were destroyed. But yeah, the Assyrians were basically replaced by the Babylonians, and when the Assyrians invaded, they were stopped short of Jerusalem. So they only took out the 10 northern tribes. So at this point forward, we're talking about Jews as we are during the entire book of Daniel, because the rest of Israel has been scattered. And Judah is all that's identifiable. All right, we all clear on the history? Actually, there's something else I want to say by way of introduction before we go on. One of the things that I've asserted several times is the Bible serves as really good character and leadership studies. And you see the personalities of different major characters in the Bible, and you can learn a lot from them. So, for example, Judah is the one who takes responsibility. Levi is the hothead, and on and on, and we've been through all of that. Daniel is yet another personality type, and you want to contrast Daniel with Mordecai, because both the book of Daniel and the book of Esther give you case studies of how do you behave in exile. These are the two major books of exile. The third one is actually the end of Genesis and Exodus under Joseph, but that is somewhat different. So you have two different guys in exile. You've got Mordecai, who's a Benjaminite, and you've got Daniel, who's from Judah. They will each demonstrate the characteristics of their tribe. Daniel is from Judah. Judah is good at taking responsibility. When the kings are from Judah, things typically run better than when the kings are from some other tribe. And Daniel turns out to be a really competent administrator. When Jacob dies and gives the prophecy over his sons, says Benjamin is a ravening wolf, right? What happens when Mordecai is running things? He winds up basically advising Esther. She then blindsides Haman. And for those of you who sat in on the Esther study, Haman got set up and mousetrapped by Esther, and he never even saw it coming. And then at the end of the day, Esther goes to the king and says, it's been a month and a half since Haman died, and you haven't done anything about the decree for destruction of my people. And I assert, and I still believe, that at that point she has got her spurs as a player in palace politics. And the king saw what she did to his chief advisor. And there she is standing in front of him basically saying, oh, king, live forever, if it pleases the king, all that kind of oriental stuff. But hidden back of that is, this gal is dangerous. So he brings in Mordecai. And Mordecai then sets things up so that basically all the anti-Semites in Persia die in battle with the Jews. And Jews basically run the Persian Empire for the next several hundred years. And there is no hint of anti-Semitism in Persia until you get the rise of Ahmadinejad in modern times. Persian Empire was a major center of Judaism. The Babylonian Talmud was written there. Jews lived in prosperity and peace in Persia after Mordecai. So Judah in the person of Daniel and Benjamin in the person of Mordecai, both are major players in their respective empires, you know, same geographical area. But the way they do it is different. And the results they achieve are different. And so I'm suggesting that you, as you go through this, pay attention to that, because it teaches us one of the ways to get along while we're in exile. So now, Daniel chapter 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Just as a side bar here, in the book of Kings, maybe, the Babylonians sent some ambassadors to Jerusalem. And the king, which may have been, and I'm doing this by memory, I've not looked this up, this just jogged my memory. And the young king, he was a young king in Jerusalem, took him around, gave him the tour, and he included showing him all the treasures of the temple and all that kind of stuff. And one of his advisors looked at him and says, what, you got cornflakes for brains? So Nebuchadnezzar, when he's coming back, knows that there is a tremendous amount of treasure associated with the temple. And of course, Solomon had amassed a great deal of wealth during the time that he was king. So the idea that Nebuchadnezzar would sort of show up on a Sunday afternoon to plunder the place, especially since his ambassador would have brought back to him the news that, wow, that's a rich place. and they are not militarily comparable to you, O king. You know, that sort of gives rise to the criminal instinct in the government. Verse 3. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. Chaldeans, again, are the people of Babylon. In other words, Babylon is the city. The people are Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. So he's got these four young men. As I say, they were picked for being bright, for being of noble families, and for being good looking. And the idea is they're hostages, and we're going to train them up, and they're going to be an integral part of our court. So while they're going to be part of our court, get them all cleaned up so that they look good, smell nice, and sound good. Verse 8. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who assigned your food and your drink. For why should he see that you are in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king. Obviously we know about kosher diet. The king of the Babylonians doesn't follow it. And the chief eunuch has got two problems. Problem number one is, of course, if these kids wilt like potted plants that haven't been watered, he's going to be in trouble. But the second part of that is, if they wilt like potted plants that haven't been watered, he is going to be suspected of taking the food from the king's table and selling it in town. So he says, no. I can't afford to do this. You have got to eat the best stuff because you got to be looking good. Otherwise, I'm in real trouble. Verse 11. So Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel. All right. Now notice we got two different people here. First off, you've got the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuch says, hey, you got to eat the right stuff. Then Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel. So we got a chief of the eunuch flunky who's actually dishing out the chow. The chief eunuch says, no, you got to eat the good stuff. And Daniel then prevails on the guy that's actually bringing the food. Then Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servants for 10 days. Let us begin vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who ate the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So the deal is, okay, I know that this is what we've been, but if you give us, you know, potato salad and beans and stuff like that and water to drink, check us after 10 days, and if we don't look any the worse for wear, you know all this king food that you've got? You now have an opportunity to sell it in town. Do you understand the incentive here? There's the opportunity for graft here as long as the graft is not too dangerous. The question you have to ask, or I have to ask myself, you don't have to ask yourself anything if you don't want to. The question I ask myself is, you've got these Hebrew hostages. The king has said, feed them from my table. They've said they don't want to. What's the incentive on your part to go with the wishes of the hostages as opposed to the orders of the king? Verse 14. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. So again, this is not the chief eunuch that's doing this. This is one of the chief eunuch's flunkies. Verse 17. As for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Notice we're setting up Daniel's resume here. Daniel is one, somebody who stands up for his understanding of what his God requires of him. Number two, he's a smart guy. Number three, he has understanding in visions and dreams, which is going to be useful in a little bit. At the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king spoke to them, and among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they stood before the king. In other words, they were taken into his court, his immediate sphere. And in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. Persia conquered Babylon in 539 BC. That's when we have the handwriting on the wall and all that kind of stuff, which we'll get to. Daniel is taken in as a counselor to Cyrus. And now at that point, if the chronology is right, and he was taken into captivity in 605, and Babylon is destroyed in 539, then we are talking, what, 61 plus 5? So he's been 66 years in captivity, at which time he started as a teenager. So he is easily in his 70s or 80s at the time that Persia conquers Babylon, and he is again picked up as a major government functionary by Cyrus. Chapter 2. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His spirit was troubled and his sleep left him. Then the king commanded that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans be summoned to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. And the king said to them, I had a dream, and my spirit was troubled to know the dream. Then the Chaldeans said to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the word from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you shall be torn limb from limb, and your houses shall be laid in ruins. But if you show the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and its interpretation. There's about three different interpretations of this. Now, notice first off when it occurs in his reign. Second year of his reign. So he's a very young king at this point. His father has died, and he has come back out of the field. He's been a field commander. He's come back out of the field to take over the kingship from his dead father. And he's got all of these advisors. And he hasn't lived in the palace for a while. Say he's been out on campaign. So he comes back and he's got this staff that his dad put together, and he doesn't know whether they're competent or not. So one way to look at this is, all right, let's see what these folks are made of. That's one way. Way number two to look at it is, I don't know about you, but I have had dreams that have very strongly moved me. And awakened the next morning knowing I had had such a dream but not being able to tell you what it was. So it's also very possible that he had a very strong dream which woke him up and moved him and all that kind of stuff, but he doesn't actually remember what it was. That is also a possibility. So, you know, to call in your advisors and say, I was awakened in the middle of the night by this dream, but I don't want to tell you, I don't remember what it was. So, you tell me the dream and you tell me the interpretation. Okay, that's another way to look at this. I have no idea which is correct. Verse 7. They answered a second time and said, "Let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show its interpretation." The king answered and said, "I know with certainty that you are trying to gain time because you see that the word from me is firm. If you do not make the dream known to me, there is but one sentence for you. You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the times change. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me its interpretation." That would lend some weight to the first interpretation, which is to say he's checking them out to see if they're any good. King James lends credence to interpretation number two. The king answered and said, "I know of a certainty that ye would gain that time, because ye see the thing has gone from me," which would lend credence to the idea that he has forgotten it. Actually, New English Standard leans more towards one, which gives the impression that he's saying, you guys are trying to gain time and get me talking. In other words, you're trying to weasel this out of me with conversation kind of a thing. As I say, it could be either way. I hadn't read it in King James. That's really neat. Verse 10. The Chaldeans answered the king and said, "There is not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand. For no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean." In other words, hey, rookie king, you're making unreasonable demands here. You're asking for something that can't be given. Rookie, okay, that's, again, sort of the unspoken thing there, because the guy's only been king for 2 years, remember? And what they're saying is no other king would ask such a dumb thing, is basically the subtext there. Verse 11, "The thing that the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh." Verse 12, "Because of this, the king was angry and very furious and commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed," which tells us something about Nebuchadnezzar. He's a hothead, and also he tends to make decisions that he later regrets. Verse 13, "So the decree went out, and the wise men were about to be killed, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them." The deal here is, it's go out and kill everybody with the job description of wise men. Daniel falls under that job description. So what Nebuchadnezzar is doing in this process is he's basically cleaning out the entire staff of wise guys in his court, and he's going to start over. So the fact that Daniel is about to be whacked has nothing to do with Daniel personally. It has to do with his job description. 14. "Then Daniel replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard." Notice prudence and discretion. "Who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He declared to Arioch, the king's captain, 'Why is the decree of the king so urgent?' Then Arioch made the matter known to Daniel, and Daniel went in and requested the king to appoint him a time that he should show the interpretation to the king." All right, so this is guts. Now, the fact that you've been slated to be killed is not a good thing. However, if you go in and personally tick off the king, you're still going to be killed, but you may be roasted slowly over a slow fire, as opposed to just have your throat cut or hanged or, you know, whatever the method of execution was in Persia. So for him to waltz in to the king and say, you know, "Hey, give me 24 hours and I'll come back and tell you the thing," is guts. I mean, it really is. So, verse 17. "Then Daniel went to his house and made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions." Notice the Hebrew names here. "And told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven, and Daniel answered and said," so this is Daniel's prayer, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding." I find that interesting. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. To those who have will be given more. Also, I'm not going to go into mashalim right now, but this is a mashal. mashalim or couplets that the first phrase of the couplet sets up the premise, the second phrase completes and intensifies it. So he gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. But again, the idea is, at least in this prayer, God is not represented as starting with a blank slate. He picks somebody who is able to receive what is given him. 22. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. And again, notice that's a mashal. Reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we asked of you. For you have made known to us the king's matter. Therefore Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He said thus to him, "Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will show the king the interpretation." Then Arioch brought Daniel before the king in haste and said thus to him, "I have found among the exiles from Judah a man who will make known to the king the interpretation." Notice the bureaucratic positioning. Hey, I am the chief of your guards. I have found somebody who can interpret this dream. I have brought him to you, O king. So notice in that process that Arioch himself is taking a risk. Because if Daniel falls flat on his face, the king is subject to look at the, "You brought me who? You brought me this guy?" Arioch is taking some risk in this process. And I sort of get the impression that Arioch and Daniel know each other. Because remember, Arioch is in the, comes tromping into the barracks or wherever it is Daniel is staying, and he said, "Okay, you're next. We're killing all the wise men." And Daniel is able to talk him out of it for a brief time. That sort of gives to me the flavor that perhaps they have known each other for a while. In which case, gives perhaps some understanding of why Arioch would take the risk. Okay, because it is a risk for him. Because his last instruction was to go kill them all. And if instead of going and killing them all, he shows up with one of them under his arm and says, I didn't do what you told me, O king. I didn't kill them all. And furthermore, this guy's going to be able to tell you about the dream and its interpretation. And again, we've seen Nebuchadnezzar as a bit of a hothead. 26. The king declared to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, "Are you able to make known to me the dream that I have seen and its interpretation?" Daniel answered the king and said, "No wise men, enchanters, magicians, or astrologers can show to the king the mystery that the king has asked. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head as you lay in the bed are these. To you, O king, as you lay in your bed, came thoughts of what would be after this. And he who reveals mysteries made known to you what is to be. But as for me, the mystery has been revealed to me, not because of any wisdom that I have more than all the living, but in order that the interpretation may be made known to the king, that you may know the thoughts of your mind." Notice this. First off, this is very, very similar to Joseph's speech before Pharaoh. Gives all the credit to God, and also tells, as did Joseph, the reason that you got this dream is so that you will know what's coming. Not me, you. So in the case of Pharaoh, it's so that you will know what's coming and can make preparation for the 7 fat years and the 7 lean years so that Egypt will not perish. In other words, you're the king, you're on the throne, you're the one that's going to take action. God is using me to tell you what's going to happen. And that's the same message that Daniel gives to Nebuchadnezzar. Not word for word, but in substance is exactly the same. We don't have time to go through the dream. So we'll break off here and we'll pick it up at 31 next time.